somebody told me that I couldn't do something because of the way that I looked. And as a result, I decided to challenge that. I ended up being crowned Miss Canada, which surprised everybody, including me, considering I had never even seen a pageant before. And then...
Welcome to Tech Talks, hosted by myself, David Savage, and powered by Nash Squared. On today's show, it is our second Black History Month special episode. We are talking to Juliet Powell, author of The AI Dilemma, Seven Principles for Responsible Technology, and academic, a member of the faculty at NYU. And joining me for the second time this week, I've got my colleague from Georgia, Kenya. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
So look, Juliet lives in New York. Now, I know that you were in New Jersey, but I assume you went into New York quite regularly, right?
Right. Not even 20 minutes from New York. So it was a regular for me to ride into the city, drive into the city. I have family that lives in the city. So, yeah, I'm a half New Yorker.
New York is one of those cities. Look, it's funny. Like, I've been once, okay? It's somewhere that everyone says that if you are European, it's probably the most easy American, North American, US city to get on in. As a European, because it is kind of similar as a US citizen. What's your view of New York? Because it does feel very different to some of the other states that I've been to.
It's fast paced. Again, it's a hustle and bustle town. You can even tell the way they walk. You know, everything is fast. If you're walking slow, they're pushing past you. They're looking at you like, what are you walking? Like, you can tell when it's a traveler within that's walking. You can tell when it's someone that's not from New York or they're not used to the structure, because they're sightseeing while they're walking. They're walking slow. They're not paying attention. They stand out. They stand out.
I'd like to hope, having lived in London for a very long time, that I didn't stand out too much. And I got the subway everywhere. I was like, no. Like, I use the tube all the time. Like, the subway is not that complicated. Look, we've got Juliet's interview. She talks a little bit about New York. She talks about AI. We'll play that, and then we'll come back with some commentary on it afterwards.
Okay.
Today, I'm lucky to be joined by Juliet Powell. Juliet, thanks for taking the time this morning, because it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the UK, but it's 8 o'clock in the morning in New York.
Yes, well, it's a city that never sleeps, so...
Well, yeah, no, that's true. I mean, is it a nice morning? I have to say, it's a beautiful day here in the UK, which is, it's quite rare for February. It's normally rubbish, but I hope that it's a nice morning where you are.
Spectacular. In fact, we've had spring-like weather, which is quite unseasonable, but I don't think winter's over yet.
Fair enough, yeah. Cold snap will probably kind of come and bite us as soon as we think that we're at the worst of it, but there we go. Anyway, not here to talk about the weather. This is an entirely British start to this podcast. You're probably wondering what on earth's going on. Before we get into anything else, do you want to introduce yourself and tell the listeners who you are and what you do?
Well, hello, everyone. It is nice to join you today. I'm Juliet Powell, and I have the amazing opportunity to be the chief experimentalist of my own life. At least that's how I like to look at it. Others view it more as I'm an independent researcher. I work in machine learning, artificial intelligence. We just wrote a book called The AI Dilemma, Seven Principles of Responsible Technology, that came out last fall. And it's been a whirlwind of a year. I mean, if you've had your eye on AI at all, it has been quite exciting, at the same time, quite nerve-wracking. So I'm really looking forward to diving in with you, David.
Let's start there, actually, because I think AI and the fact that it's been a whirlwind of a year is entirely the right way of framing it. I've been speaking to people who've kind of described organizations almost panicking and scrambling, not to want to kind of make it sensationalized, but there is that problem that we've almost been told what AI can do without a roadmap of how to get there in terms of implementing it. So when you're talking about seven principles of responsible implementation of AI or use of AI, I suppose remembering that aspect, that responsible aspect, is really crucial, right? In terms of not just rushing to the end goal.
Well, again, do we want to create our technologies in view of the technological race, potentially, you know, even of the AI wars between nations, or are we developing this stuff for the human race? And depending on the answer to those questions, we're going to be creating very different types of responsibility around machine learning.
Out of interest, what do you think the overall narrative is in the industry, but also in media? And do the two diverge? Because when you look at media from my perspective here in the UK, there does unfortunately tend to be that slightly sensationalized, divisive kind of tone to it. And I don't necessarily think it's reflective of the conversation in industry, but I'd love your perspective on where you think we're at with this debate.
So I'm a big believer in looking at things from multiple perspectives. So thank you so much for asking that question. In fact, one of the frameworks that we use in the book is very much looking at the logics of power around artificial intelligence. So who's in charge? Well, clearly the engineers are in charge. They're creating this stuff. They care a great deal about it. And what they care about is efficiency. And that, of course, is at the service of the corporate mindset, which is all about making money before the regulation comes in. It's the Wild West out there, and we must monetize. Boards are asking this. People that have, you know, stocks and bonds in these large companies are really looking to make as much money as possible. Just look at NVIDIA and so many others that we've seen in the last quarter. And then, of course, there's the social justice perspective. Are we developing this at the service of humankind, as I mentioned earlier, which is really, really important, I think, for all of us as humans. But of course, as soon as you put your corporate hat on, you're again thinking about the monetization. If you're thinking about it from a governmental perspective, there's a lot of pressure on politicians all over the world, especially with 60 elections in 2024 all over the world. We're already seeing some very terrifying things in terms of deep fakes, the $25 million heist that happened in Hong Kong. So all of these stories are kind of coming out depending on which news source you look at, what your interests are. I'm really interested in all of it because I don't think that we can actually have a productive conversation without understanding all of these perspectives simultaneously. Hmm. And I don't think that there are very many media outlets that are doing that, or perhaps they're doing it in an ad hoc fashion. But I do think that, you know, all of the talk around the AIA coming out of the EU is exciting. For many, I think people in the EU are very excited about it generally, unless they work in big tech. On the other hand, here in the United States, the truth is that, you know, big tech is still grappling with GDPR. I mean, years later, what was that, 2018? So I do not think that big tech is ready yet for the fines that are going to be coming out of the AIA anytime soon. At the same time, one of the things that I've been keeping an eye on, I don't know about you, David, is the fact that big tech is now obviously offering insurance to their clients, to their customers, if they want to use these tools so that if they get sued, they're covered. And we're seeing big tech really putting huge amounts of money on the side specifically for these lawsuits, specifically for these fines. So I'm not sure if the everyday person is necessarily, you know, keeping their eye on all of these things simultaneously. How about you?
Well, it's fascinating that you say that, right? Because this is where that different perspective thing really comes into being. Because the conversations that I've been having are organizations are holding back with implementing this stuff because they know regulations coming down the pipeline and they don't want to be in a situation where they're retrospectively implementing because of regs. Right. And whilst we might see life sciences pushing ahead with large-scale rollouts, actually, for the most part, we're seeing proof of concepts. Mm-hmm. The position, the picture that you're painting is quite different in that make as much money whilst we're able to make as much money as possible and even have a slush fund there available to protect ourselves when it gets a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a pipeline, of course, between emerging tech and the U.S. government. So they've created ways for much smaller companies, like companies that are born in college dorms, to get into that DoD pipeline if they've got a technology that might be useful for the government, whether it's for bad actors or for extreme innovation, radical innovation. They want to make sure that A, it's done responsibly. So there are new guidelines there that are coming out of the White House. And at the same time, they want to be able to optimize on the potential benefits of having these technologies first. So they're invested both on a financial level as well as, you know, the idea that the United States wants to attain AI supremacy by 2025, and so does China.
From a perspective then of those people who are concerned with this technology being built for the good of society, where's the hope? Because if you look at the states and recent Senate hearings and so on, it appears that government is wholly inadequate at holding big tech to account.
Yes, it appears again and again and again that that's.
Yeah. And you just mentioned China. They're probably not going to be overly worried or concerned about intellectual property and so on, you know, as long as they can make a lot of money. The big tech companies themselves, as you said, that they've made their ambitions quite clear. So where does the handbrake or the guardrails get applied in a way that actually doesn't stifle innovation, doesn't stop technology moving us forward in terms of opportunity, but does have that wraparound that means that we're looking after people and it's a kind of effect on society at the same time?
You're asking the question that all of us are trying to answer simultaneously and oftentimes speaking past each other as opposed to with each other. So what I like about the AIA coming out of the EU is that it's risk-based. And I think that basis is very much steeped in human rights. And that is a sharp distinction with what's coming out of the United States, generally around regulation. First off, it's much more ad hoc, state by state. There are, again, some guidelines that are coming out of the White House. But generally, regulation in the United States is based on property law. So it's based on ownership. And as you know, individuals do not own their own data. Right. At this point, we're talking about who's holding the data, who's controlling the data, who's monetizing the data. And that's not the day-to-day individual. So when we talk about power around AI, who has the power? It's really those that can control and monetize the data and choose to do what they wish with it. At the same time, coming back to, you know, the companies that you were talking about that are holding back, that are trying to see how best to innovate and make that balance with, you know, the rights of people and making sure that we don't hurt people, that we don't kill people, that we don't, you know, in some way stop them from being able to live their own potential because they're caught in negative biases and algorithmic debacles. I do think that, at least from what I'm seeing here in the United States, Canada, North America overall, and I'm going to Finland tomorrow, so that my answer might change when I come back. but what I'm seeing is, again, the people that are in power in companies are less focused on the risks. And I think getting back to your question, we all need to do a calculus of intentional risk around how we experiment and deploy these technologies. The seventh principle in the book is around creative friction. This idea that you need to bring in the actual populations that you're trying to serve with your technologies, whether it's inside the organization or outside of the organization, so that they can help you actually create technology that will work for them, that will work for you, that will work for society, as well as for these larger goals of monetization. I think, you know, having more people in the room with more diverse perspectives, and I'm not just talking about race, I'm talking about gender, I'm talking about, you know, neurodiversity, different backgrounds, different cultures, different educations. You know, there are a lot of people that are working in AI that are self-taught right now, so they have very different backgrounds from the traditional people that have been working in this space for a very long time. And again, very, very different perspectives. While I was doing the research for the book, I was lucky enough to have Professor Stark out of Columbia University kind of be one of my advisors. And he had done a lot of work on Wall Street as well as the stock exchange in Tokyo. And what he found is that the most productive teams were the most diverse teams, which is kind of counterintuitive because, as you know, when you get a bunch of really diverse perspectives in a room, you tend to deliberate longer because people ask more questions. Well, what about this and what about that? But the outcomes tend to be better for more people. And in terms of, you know, the stock exchange, it just meant that these teams made way more money. So these are things that we need to take into account as we're developing these technologies, as we're deploying them. Bring your communities in, because they can really come up with scenarios, like doomsday scenarios, as well as optimistic scenarios that you would have missed, that you want to have in mind as you're doing your experimentation, so that you don't be, you're not taken with your pants down, so to speak. So this calculus of intentional risk must include multiple perspectives and really looking at the risks and benefits from a short-term perspective, medium-term, and long-term, and then aligning that with your actual risk-benefit analysis for the company. These two things need to go together. They're not separate things.
Now, you just mentioned a professor at Columbia. You are a member of the faculty at NYU.
Yes.
You also are quite clearly an expert where it comes to AI and an author and someone working in technology. You talked about race. You talked about gender. You talked about background. You also talked about bias and biases. And there's no elegant way of putting this, but you do not conform to the statistical norm of a AI professor, I would imagine, or certainly not someone working in technology. That's fair to say?
It is fair to say, I would suspect, from a global perspective.
Unfortunately so, yeah. And look, I wish that wasn't the case, but so be it. For the time being, let's try and tackle this, because your background is fascinating. And I think the industry would be in a much better place if there were more people that have come at this, your journey and bringing your perspective into the industry. Do you just want to kind of fill in some of the gaps that I am alluding to? Kind of where are you from originally, and how did you end up working in technology?
I was born in New York. I grew up partially in the United States and partially in Canada. My mother was French Canadian. And so moving from the US to Canada, all of a sudden I had to learn French and forget my English. This was very important in Quebec. If you've been to Montreal for any expense of time, you know that your life is much better if you're able to be perfectly bilingual. And at the time I really, really resented it, but ironically, it actually helped me so much in terms of being able to program. So when I was a teenager, my math professor pointed out that I was very good at math and suggested that I study mechanical engineering. And I was lucky enough to be accepted into a program when I was still in high school at the local university, Concordia University. And by some strange turn of events, somebody told me that I couldn't do something. And I got really angry. It bothered me that somebody told me that I couldn't do something because of the way that I looked. And as a result, I decided to challenge that. I ended up being crowned Miss Canada, which surprised everybody, including me, considering I had never even seen a pageant before. And then, so I sadly from there did not finish studying mechanical engineering. I ended up not being able to get a job after I finished the pageant and wondered what would I do with my life. And I ended up watching something on television, a really horrible interview. It was a live interview on television. I thought, oh, I can do a better job than that. And next thing you know, I showed up at the TV station and they were like, they're like, you know nothing, but we're going to give you a chance. And so I started out in live television in Montreal, speaking in French, interviewing celebrities. And then I wrote a show because I was also studying business at McGill University simultaneously, wrote a show, wrote the business end. I was laughed at the TV station. And then I got really pissed off. And I think you're starting to understand that when I get pissed off, I tend to do things. So I pitched the show to the person that had founded the television network and he loved it. So I ended up becoming a show creator and host and doing a bunch of different things in television in Toronto, but also working on the back end, trying to figure out how to use the data to get more traction, if you will, both on television as well as online. And then I come from the land of research in motion. So we were alpha testing, this is way back in the day, things like BlackBerry phones, and started to understand that all of this data really gave us a sense of who a person was, what they cared for, and ultimately, how are people manipulated through marketing, through advertising? And I was kind of shocked that I was part of this larger machine and most of my colleagues didn't really get what I was talking about. So Long story short, I moved to the United States and 9/11 had happened. Social media was just picking up, and there it is, the social graph, and look at how we can influence others. And so I ended up writing a book about that, ended up becoming a mentor for the TED conference that I had helped produce years before. And with all of that, worked on an incredible project with Intel Labs, mapping the personal data ecosystem on a global level. And again, understanding that the majority of people in the world, A, don't even have a sense of, you know, what their data trails are, let alone how they're being monetized by large organizations and governments even in the world, and how we're all affected by developing technologies much more so. And so, again, I think of the billions of people that are coming online and how they're being affected. So it's difficult enough for us in G8 countries to kind of realize to what extent our lives are underpinned by artificial intelligence. But then people that don't have that kind of background, I just, you know, I'm curious, I'm passionate. And when I see that people invite me to the table, I'm lucky enough to have enough confidence to show up and shut up. Most of the time I listen and then I connect the dots.
You are the poster child perhaps for career shifting. I mean, in terms of the amount of different experiences that you've been able to kind of bring to the table in various different roles throughout your career, I think that's something where, you know, technology can really benefit from bringing people in who don't necessarily, or maybe wouldn't have considered a career in technology earlier in their professional life. What do you think people coming, obviously you did study mechanical engineering, absolutely, but obviously you're working in television and so on and so forth. But what do you think you would say to those who maybe hadn't considered technology, might think that technology is inaccessible, but there is opportunity there for them, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that I learned when I went back to school at Columbia. It's what I learn every day when I'm teaching at NYU or, you know, working with the World Bank. Ultimately, I think that we are so lucky to be alive at this particular moment in time. Those that have access to these technologies, as I'm thinking specifically about generative AI right now, and the opportunity to start a business, to start a company, to actually shape the direction of these technologies, to come up with the next generations of, you know, possibility in terms of tools. And I really think that now is the time to jump in. In terms of generative AI, there are very few experts. So that means that it's an even playing field. If you are able to use technology, if you have an affinity to it, if you're curious, if you ask better questions than the majority of people. And I think that once we start understanding that anybody, just about anybody, can actually run with this technology, we often refer to the bad actors in those thought experiments. But I like to think about the next generation of entrepreneurs that are potentially going to look more like me than they do like you. And what kind of world will we have when we have, I guess we give more access to more people. And right now that access is there thanks to all of these free tools. I don't know to what extent they're going to remain free. So now's the time to do those experimentations while remaining responsible. Again, that creative friction, really, really important. And also doing small tests, because oftentimes the experiments that we're seeing don't necessarily scale. So we have to be very, very careful if we want to be responsible.
You mentioned that when you were a student, someone perceived what you could or couldn't do based on their perception of how you looked.
Yeah.
People have obviously made assumptions about you based on the way that you look, for, you know, whether that's gender or race or anything else throughout your life.
The same thing of you, David, though. I mean, look at you. I would think the same of you, right? First off, you're born with an excellent name. Secondly, I mean, I would think that people think that you're very, very attractive. You're clearly very successful, but there are biases, right? There are negative biases. There are confirmation biases. There are so many different kinds of ways that we put people in boxes. So, yes.
Yeah, of course. And look, I think throughout the majority of my life, I have benefited from bias rather than it's probably not negatively impacted me because I come from a relatively privileged background and so on. And you know, I suppose you have to be aware of that in your life if you have benefited from it. What I was going to ask is where people feel that they have not been fairly treated, and it has negatively impacted the opportunities that they have. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate this is difficult, but how do we tackle that? Either on an individual level as a society, what steps can we try and do to create an opportunity to create a world where there is more equal opportunity for people, and it's not predicated by someone's bias on how you look or the way they perceive you?
Again, let's start with this podcast. So you were kind enough to find me in the world, and I so appreciate that. But one of the first things that you said to me is, look, it's February. It's Black History Month in the United States. As a result, right, you literally pinned the interview based on that specific premise. And that shows that you're incredibly open-minded. But the question is, will you have me back again when it's not Black History Month, when you're mm-hmm. not trying to shine a light on inequity and potentially on opportunity? I don't know the answer to that question. I think that it's a question that needs to be answered by action as opposed to just talk. So examining our own personal biases, absolutely, especially when we go online, especially when we interact with others in a mediated, federated field where what we're saying isn't just one-on-one, it's one on many. So having that presence of mind on an ongoing basis isn't easy, but I do think that it's necessary just even to build our relationships in a more equitable world. If we can also keep that in mind when we go into our work mode, that's pretty important too. So not just keeping on your, you know, boss hat, but also remembering that the person in front of you is an equal because they're a human being, no matter what they look like or whatever their background is. And I think that we get so caught up, especially those of us who work in technology and trying to accelerate everything that we do through our technology, or even answering our human issues by throwing more technology at it, is a mistake. So I think first and foremost, the answer to, I guess, the overarching question that you have is that we need to be able to fix that human bias within us, which I don't think is ever going to go away, but at least to start to address it and see where they are. And ultimately, as I said earlier, to ask better questions of ourselves so that we can ask better questions of our data and of our technologies and where we want to go with it.
Yeah. Look, and I think that's an entirely fair challenge to lay. So thank you. I think it's good to have that awareness. Look, we're running out of time, so let's wrap up here. Where do we find the book?
Probably online. Amazon seems to be the number one bookseller in the world, as far as I can tell. But the reality is, you know, you can just come to julietpaul.com. For people that don't have the money to buy the book, reach out to me and we'll send you a PDF. At the very least, it's one thing that I can do for the world that doesn't cost too much and that hopefully brings joy.
And if we turn our attention back very quickly to AI, and with the focus being that this is predominantly a podcast aimed at business leaders, what is one message that you would try and ensure that someone listening to this goes away with?
Please keep an open mind to other logics of power than your own, right? Keep in mind that the government logic, the corporate logic, the engineering logic, and the social justice logic are all forces of power around this technology. And the more that we can put ourselves into the mind of the other logics as we make decisions, the better the technology is going to be for more people.
Thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a lovely day and that the weather stays positive for you throughout it.
Thank you so much, David, and I hope to see you on another podcast.
There's a comment that Juliet makes in the interview where someone says to her that she couldn't do something because of the way that she looked. As someone who has grown up with a lot of privilege, that is a very jarring comment to hear. I cannot imagine what it's like to hear it.
I have experienced being overlooked for jobs that I knew that I was qualified for, more so overqualified for, and a person that next to me that wasn't the same color as me came in as entry level and got hired. I've experienced more than one occasion. The feeling is unexplainable, but it also gives you more of a eager feeling to push harder, push forward. You know, it's unfortunate that the mindset you get is like I have to do more to be noticeable, and I have to be better, you know, than the person next to me just to get in the room, you know. So I can relate. I can relate to that, you know. It's either it's gonna make you or gonna break you type of thing, you know.
We've asked you on the show because obviously it is Black History Month, and because of these experiences and trying to kind of talk about progress and change. But honestly speaking, what's your opinion or attitude of Black History Month? Because, you know, I sit in our Pride ARG, and the members of the LGBT community where Pride is concerned, they're quite mixed about it. Like they are very wary of pink washing, of pride washing. They don't want it necessarily just to be this case that we kind of put out a whole load of celebrations during a month and then we move on and that's it. How do you feel about Black History Month?
You know, listening to Juliet's speak, she made a great point and a great statement. As the month of February, everything is focused on Black history. You know, honestly, it's not even 30 days in this month. You know, we get the shortest month of the year to focus on people of color. The question is, what do you do after February? You know, are you still eager to know the culture after February, or is it a thing that it's just for that moment, you know? And I think a lot of times, well, throughout these years, that's the outlook on it from probably a lot of people of color, you know, like we're glorified for a couple of days, but after that, you know, it's back to what I would say they think is normal for them, you know, back to the norm, you know. So that's how I look at it. I think it's more now of just people being more open, and the biasness is not going to go away, but it's just more so of addressing it, you know, and being able to go beyond February, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Juliet is absolutely right to point the finger at us with the podcast. I mean, I'd like to think, actually, if you look at the back catalogue and what we talk about, it certainly isn't restricted just to February, but it's a constant reminder that is something that's a continual renewal of trying to make sure that you broaden the conversation and you make it as inclusive as you can.
Right.
Anything else that, from your perspective, really jumped out? Because obviously you're going to see this from a very different perspective to me, I suppose, on a number of different levels.
She's very passionate. You can tell in just how she was speaking. She's passionate in what she's doing, what she has done. And to see that she's bringing more diversity to AI. And she made a statement that makes so much sense. And she said the most diverse teams are more productive teams. And it makes so much sense. And for her to be a person to be able to make that happen in the world is awesome. You know, like she's taking the initiative, she's taking a step to make diversity in areas or that's not so common of us to be in.
Yeah, and I think she's you can tell that people have made assumptions about her on a number of different levels.
Yeah.
Throughout her career and life. So,
and look how many career changes she had, you know, like she was in television, you know, doing interviews with celebrities, you know, and just to know she's given more access to people.
Just very quickly before we wrap up, from our own ERG's perspective, kind of what have we been working on that you're really kind of proud to be part of in terms of Ethnacity?
So I'm with Ethnacity with Harvey Nash. It's a group that some of my, you know, our colleagues, we come together monthly and we acknowledge different backgrounds, let's put it that way, which is awesome because, again, this is something that we're, you know, as colleagues all around the world, that we are able to interact with one another. And we acknowledge culture. We make the initiative to bring it to Harvey Nash. We've opened up a lot of doors, I think, now since we've been doing it. We have great interaction within the company that we didn't. I think this is something good for the for Harvey Nash. It's engaging colleagues that are not normally, well, let's just say that's normally just do your work, put your head down type of thing. I think it's bringing a new shed of light to Harvey Nash.
Well, look, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show this week. I think we should get you on when it's not February. It's not the shortest month of the year. Talking about something entirely different that's got bugger all to do with race and background and anything else.
I'm all for it, Dave.
Thank you for taking the time.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Tech Talks is hosted and edited by David Savage. It is produced by Nash Squared. And we have special thanks to Lemzy for supplying music to this show.